Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And this morning, we're going to be addressing some very critical issues in the foodieverse.
Are we?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, why is everybody so excited about food trucks?
Well, we ought to...
Food trucks used to be just like...
Carts.
Yeah. And the equivalent of indigestion on a stick.
Well, no. It's very different.
Now that's all changing, and we're starting out today's program with two different versions of that.
Yeah, starting with John T. Edge.
The very learned John T. Edge of the University of Mississippi and Southern Foodways, and then an old writer friend who circles the world regularly.
Yes.
Rich, Robert Reed from Lonely Planet. So, we'll start off with John T., and then, in the next segment we'll have, Lonely Planet's Green version, and then we'll go on to something else.
John T. Edge is a Beard Award journalist. Congratulations belatedly for this year's MFK Fisher Award, John T.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that's a real accomplishment. She was one of the most beautiful writers, I think. I mean, that's an honor. Anyhow, and you are too. You've turned your attention, though, for this project to truck food. It's the Truck Food Cookbook.
Yes.
And 150 recipes and ramblings from America's best restaurants on wheels. John, it is a hot topic, but what really turned you on to writing this book?
Well, I think in this moment when everyone is aware of the import of farm-to-table connections, I think that we want to eat great food at lunch, too, when we're in a hurry. We want to eat great food fast and don't want to eat fast food. So what interested me was this generation of young cooks and chefs who were embracing truck food, cart food, street food as a way to deliver really fantastic, well-sourced, artisanal food on a paper plate. And I documented that, and in doing it, also fell in love with kind of the roots of this phenomenon, which are Mexican-American taco truck drivers and operators all across the Southwest.
I guess the question comes up, and you've been on this book tour, and I'm so afraid that I'm going to ask you one more question that you've had to answer 1,000 times, because we all sort of I'm in on the same things. But what is the difference between... I remember there were always vendors on the street in food carts when I was in school, and they were always ethnic. What is new about this current culture of food truck cuisine?
Well, those vendors... Where were you in school? Where did you see these?
Well, they were all over Pittsburgh.
Okay, yeah.
In Michigan and Ann Arbor.
Sure.
Yeah, there are lots of them in Portland, Oregon.
Sure, there are. I think what's different now are two things. I think there's, throughout the U.S., there are three generations now of Mexican-American vendors who have been working taco trucks, and a taco truck for people who are of Mexican descent is an everyday indulgence, and for people who are not of Mexican descent, like myself, there's a couple of generations of people who grew up eating at taco trucks as an everyday experience. The best taco trucks deliver amazing food, well composed. There's an art to a composition of a taco, and served from a good taco truck. I really appreciate that. I think what's new too, though, and so that's not necessarily new, that's, for me, what I try to do is kind of reframe people's understanding of taco trucks. What's happened too is that as new immigrants from Southeast Asia and from Africa have arrived here in the U.S., they've brought their foods too. So in Madison, Wisconsin, I write about the Baraka cart, which is an East African cart serving wok and injera and the like. And I write about banh mi vendors in Los Angeles. The food scene in the U.S. from carts, from trucks, really looks like kind of a United Nations food court. And I think it more accurately reflects who we are in the U.S. right now and this great diversity of ethnicities that contribute to our food scene.
But there's a huge tradition of food trucks around the world, right? And I guess,
sure.
I guess we think of places like Singapore and Hong Kong and Bangkok and all over India as being street food, just being also a whole lot more complex than tacos.
Yeah, and across the U.S., I think what I see is a reinvigoration of that kind of street food in the U.S. I mean, there was a long tradition in the U.S. of street food that was, in essence, legislated out of existence in the early years of the 20th century in kind of an American fit of we attempted to purge ourselves of ethnic food traditions, and at the same time, we were concerned about the health and sourcing of ingredients. If you think about the jungle and that moment with Upton Sinclair, we were concerned about where our food was from, coming from, and we were also concerned about dominant American voices. We're concerned about ethnicity and trying to cleanse America of those ethnic influences. Now we've matured, and people are, I think, re-embracing a broad spectrum of foods that are served from carts and trucks and trailers and are eaten on the street. It's kind of a joyous moment to me.
Well, you don't make a distinction then between these kinds of ethnic food trucks and the kind that, like, what's his name, Ludo Bits. I mean,
I think they're part of the same continuum. Whether in this book I write about two women in Minneapolis, Minnesota, who run something called Chef Shack. One worked with Daniel Hum of 11 Madison. Another worked for Morimoto in Philadelphia, and they dish the recipes in the book. They dish the most beautiful cardamom spiced donut.
Right.
They use organic flours. Beautiful, well composed food. But I see a connection between them and the first generation immigrant working, serving up carne asada on a Comal fresh tortilla. I see connectivity between there. I don't see a difference. I see a quality of food is what they have in common.
Now, could you give us some idea of your intended organization for this book?
Sure. Well, I wrote this book as a travelogue. So you visit in this book 12 different cities across the U.S., from Tucson, Arizona, and Los Angeles, California, San Francisco, California, and Portland, Seattle, Durham, North Carolina, Houston, Texas, Austin, Texas, New York, Philadelphia, Minneapolis. So you visit all those cities.
That sort of surprised me, because I would think that the climate has a lot to do with the food truck phenomenon, and Minneapolis is not exactly conducive to eating standing up on outside in the winter.
My colleague Angie Mosier, who photographed some of this book, was visited trucks up that way in November, December, and there's a great shot in the book of a December, like, 23rd shot in Madison with someone vending in the snow. people got to eat, even if it's cold outside.
Well, I mean, some of these recipes are, first of all, just mentioning the fact that this readers are actually going to be able to take the recipes and reproduce these foods at home. They don't have to go and find the truck. But I don't understand at all how you managed to squeeze the recipes out of these people.
Well, for many people, you're right, these are kind of dowry recipes. These are their grandparents' ideal roasted chicken taco or their grandmother's falafel recipe. So these people are quite generous. And one of the beautiful things about this style of food is, you know, these are small restaurants on wheels, and the cooks who run them are generous folk. That said, there's probably 20% of the recipes in the book that we did not get from the truck or the cart. We did a recipe in homage to them based on my observations and my tasting, because some people didn't want to share, and I respect that. But my colleague Angie Mosier, who developed the recipes and shot the photographs, is a charming lady and a smart one, so she's good.
She's good. Let's talk to us a little bit about some of these recipes. What are some of your most favorite foods?
Sure. Well, I mentioned a couple. Those cardamom donuts I love.
Yeah, you like those a lot. Oh, no.
I do. And I love, there's a chili in here that I like a great bit, an adzuki chili. It's a vegetarian chili. Again, from Minneapolis, a place called the Magic Bus Cafe. It's in a purple school bus. It was inspired by, these are kind of leftover hippies, and this is a Ken Kesian on the bus or off the bus kind of bus.
How about spam masubi? What is it?
Spam masubi is in the Hawaiian tradition. In Hawaii, you know, you'd find convenience stores that serve masubi, little balls of vinegared rice, and with a lobe of across it. Usually pan-fried with soy sauce and then wrapped with a strip of nori. Yeah, this is street food of Hawaii, and at a place called Marination Mobile in Seattle, a really smart entrepreneur named Kamala Saxton interprets the foods of Hawaii for the people of Seattle.
I guess the big spark came out of Los Angeles, did it not, with the Kogi truck?
Dude, that was you know, in 2008, 2009 that Kogi became quite popular. Kogi, Roy Choi, the chef, and there are a number of recipes from Mr. Choi in the book.
Now, he's not the one who's just declared himself vegetarian, is it?
I'm not familiar with that. I don't know.
Somebody, and then he backed off. I don't know.
Well, sounds like a movie star, not a chef.
Yeah, maybe.
But Mr. Choi began cooking foods that reflected his neighborhood. So he's Korean-American, and he grew up in a neighborhood that was as much Mexican-American as Korean-American. So the recipes he developed and served were things like corn tortillas with galbi or kalbi, however you care to pronounce it, short ribs, topped with kimchi. And that sounds like fusion, like and sometimes when we use that word, we imply kind of a dishonesty that somebody's trying too hard to make something. But what Kogi does in L.A. is honest fusion. It reflects that neighborhood where he grew up, and it reflects an honest conjoining and commingling of cultures, of Mexican-American and Korean-American.
Now, tell me about the future of this movement. I mean, it's been going on for a while now, and people said it was going to flare and fade. And it doesn't seem to be doing that.
No, it doesn't seem to be doing that at all. And what I've seen traveling for this book, the Truck Food Cookbook, turning to places that visited a couple of years ago, places like Minneapolis or Seattle, where there was a scattering of trucks when I visited, and now there are a couple dozen or three or four dozen. I'm in Seattle now as we talk, and went to an event last night, and from the time I was here until now, the number of trucks is quintupled. And you also see, so I think that's kind of the second tier of cities like Seattle that didn't have a really vital street food scene, but now do. And some cities that really didn't have one at all, like a place like Milwaukee. I went to something at Schlitz Park in Milwaukee, the old Schlitz plant,
yeah, right.
The old Schlitz brewery. And there were 10 carts out there, one of whom, I met a guy named, who had a place called Jeppa Joe's, and he was serving banh mi sandwiches. He'd been open 5 weeks, and there he was by himself in his trailer, as excited as he could be, dishing out banh mi sandwiches with a line 20 deep. And, you know, he's been open 5 weeks.
Now, you mentioned in Portland, Oregon, I guess, they have a sort of a critical mass concept.
A pod.
I was going to say, I mean, do you think this kind of development helps? Do you think that it's kind of a natural thing that's going to happen?
I do. I think the pod model, which you also see in a different style in Austin, Texas, where they're called trailer courts or trailer parks because the Airstream trailer is the most common conveyance there. I see that as a model that can be replicated in a number of cities because there's a big grouping. In Portland, there may be 20 carts in one pod.
They have like three of them, don't they?
They've got more than that. There's three downtown, and then there are numerous ones scattered across town. So those groupings become, like that term I used a moment ago, like a food court. Those groupings become a really efficient way to connect. If you're with a group of friends and one says, I want Vietnamese food, and the other says, no, I want Shanghai, and another person says, I want Mexican, and another person says, I want a burger. Everybody gets what they want.
Yeah. Now, what about people who start out because it's economically efficient to start out without the bricks and mortar, but then when they get their food off the ground and running, and they have some followers, they then move into the mission of street food did that.
Yeah, that's a pretty common pattern. Somebody starts with a cart or a truck and then moves into a brick-and-mortar business. I write in the book about the folks who have something called the Big Gay Ice Cream Truck in New York.
Oh, in New York, right.
I love those guys.
They're
really smart marketers. And the time between I wrote about them, at which time they were taking a Mr. Softy truck out of the Mr. Softy Truck Depot and rebranding it with kind of the rainbow colors of the gay movement. And now, so that was then. What is now is they have a shop in the Village in New York called the Big Gay Ice Cream Shop. And they've become very successful. But they're doing what they were doing before, which is they're running a small business out of a small space. It just happened to be that their space now isn't on wheels.
Yeah, and of course we should mention the social media expediting the schedules of all these people.
Yeah, that's the case in so many of the kind of new age of trucks. They're using Twitter and Tumblr and their blogging and microblogging platform. But there's still a whole range of people out there. I mentioned I'm in Seattle today, and the taco buses here, they don't use taco trucks, but they use retrofitted school buses. The buses don't move here. They don't know what the heck or care what the heck Twitter is. They're just serving putting up great mulitas and great agua fresca and the like, pickled carrots and jalapenos every day. So Twitter is a great vehicle for finding a lot of this food, but it's not the only way.
Yeah, now you yourself experienced selling hot dogs.
I did. That same idea of believing in a really quality food, I believed in the idea of a great $3 lunch and served in my hometown of Oxford, Mississippi for about 9 months along with a colleague. We sold pimento cheese slathered hot dogs on the courthouse square.
But you didn't stay in that business for very long.
I was in that business at the same time I was working full-time at the university in writing, and it was a silly thing to do, but I still I love doing it.
Well, you're very adventurous, I think, John T. I mean, you eat all that street food in Mexico as well. A surefire way of getting sick. I have that experience.
I think if you in Mexico, it can be difficult, and your experience is probably emblematic. But find if you eat at carts where the food is prepared in that moment in Mexico or wherever the case might be, and don't buy things in Mexico or in Vietnam that are sitting in ice or cold, but buy things hot and cooked. I was in Vietnam for 2 weeks and never got sick once. And I ate every day on the street.
Well, these things look yummy, and I don't know if Peter's going to tackle cooking any of these. I mean, most of it involves a lot of frying, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. The great thing about what I found eating this food, I mean, my favorite recipe in the book is from a taco truck in Austin, Texas, and it's scrambled eggs with fresh, crisped green runner bean in a beautifully handmade corn flour tortilla, a place called Taqueria Las Palomitas in Houston. It's not fried. That was the thing that was great to me, you know, the beautiful waffles from Waffles and Dingies in New York. There's fried, there's falafel, sure, but there's also a really beautiful roots jambalaya in the book from a place called the Swamp Shack in Portland, Oregon.
Oh, I love that name, yes.
It's a vegetarian dish because in Portland, a lot of people abstain from meat and still want the punch of flavor. So,
well, you must have had a glorious time researching this book. I wish you well on it, and also on your book tour, which can be grueling, I know, and thanks for breaking it up to give us a call.
It's my pleasure.
And I hope to see you soon.
I hope so, too. Thank y'all so much for being interested in the book and in my writing. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John T.
Thank y'all.
And we'll be back after the break with a more worldwide look at food trucks with Robert Reed of Lonely Planet.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. There are places in this world where you really should not be caught walking around eating things. And then there are places in this world where you absolutely should be doing exactly that. And here's somebody who knows all about street food. It's Lonely Planet's Robert Reed, who spends most of his life en route, right?
He seems to spend it en route. He seems to spend it in the most unlikely places. And he loves Indian street food more than anything else in the whole world, he says. And he's never had a digestive problem at all. So, because he's only 12 years old. so we don't know what might happen in the future. Robert, I'm pulling your leg, of course. It's always a delight to have you on the program, and I'm so glad you joined us for this particularly fine review of the world of street food.
We seem to be spending a lot of time talking to you, Robert Reed, from Lonely Planet, probably because you churn out really fascinating books and guidebooks all the time. The latest one is, from Lonely Planet, is The World's Best Street Food, Where to Find It and How to Make It. As far as I can tell, you've always been highly attracted to street food, and this particular book approaches it globally, anywhere, loosely, anything you find on the street as opposed to in a sit-down restaurant, and you divide the book into savory and sweet. Now, is that a concise enough presentation?
Very much. You said it perfectly. There's 100 different types of street food around the world, and give us some background of the origins, where to find it, how to make it. I don't know that I'm going to try to make too many. I prefer just going and having the experts do it. But a lot of people like to make a fun book to put together.
Anne asked you an interesting question while coming on the air. She said, how many times have you had food poisoning? And it is one of the things that always sort of worries me a little bit when I hear people loving the idea of street food in India, where perhaps personal hygiene is not quite up to world standards. But what was your answer?
Well, the thing is that I've never got any food poisoning from street food. And I've eaten street food in India and Nepal and across Southeast Asia and most of Central America. I have got food poisoning a couple times from travel. And the one that I know precisely where I got it was in Vietnam, where I ate street food constantly. I lived there for a year and a half in the 90s. But the place that I got it was an upscale Thai restaurant. So the thing is, you might be sitting on plastic stools and seeing the food made, but it's being made fresh before your eyes in most cases. You can see it. And in a restaurant, even a nice one, sometimes you don't know how long it's been sitting out. So it's not just that it's fun or, you know, cheaper, but in some cases, food has to be fresher. It has to be made that day, and as you wait, you can see.
Now, it's really interesting the way that your definition, because a lot of people these days are thinking that street food and food trucks are synonymous, but it's very clear from your book that you don't agree with that definition. Your definition is slightly different.
This is a little bit more of the old school definition, in the sense that it used to be, before there was kind of the street truck, street vendor revolution, places like the U.S., and all kinds of different kinds of food, and then of new fusion foods that you can get on streets, that you really kind of had to travel. You had hot dog stands in New York, but most of the U.S., for example, it was very hard to find too much out there. And so that was a great benefit of going to these places. So many of the things in this book, some of them are literally 2,000-year-old traditions that have been around. And so the focus was there on the things that call travel itself, the space between meals. And that basically your day out is anchored by the times you stop and get something to drink or eat. That's the most fun and exciting part, particularly on the street, because you can just sit and watch. That's view in a place. So we focused on those places that are kind of been around for a while, had more tradition than the street trucks. And I love the street trucks, too.
But it's also okay, in your definition, for example, something you buy and take out from a bakery, like a Cornish pasty or like an Australian meat pie, there's also a figure definition as well.
Well, that's true. You know, and I get that could be debated by some people. You go up and get a pizza slice and you take it. But there's an element that you're not sitting down in a restaurant. It's meant for portability. It's meant to go. If you get a doner kebab in Berlin, that is meant for people that are without time and they're moving along, etc. And so there's a social element of the street and the having these kinds of foods. So we made a decision that a gelato place in Italy or whatever it may be will qualify as street food as well.
Now here's a question for you. Hit on the Cornish pasty, and you give interesting things about its history, which I won't go into because that would discourage people from getting the book. But one of the foods that was traditionally eaten on the street is fish and chips, and you don't include that. And I find that a little odd, because it would seem to fit within your definition, even though it's now gone upmarket because your fish and chips isn't wrapped in newspaper anymore. It was always wrapped to go so that as you walk down the street on your way home, you could eat both the fish and the chips.
You have just built a case for street food, too. I think that when you look at Southeast Asia and all the kinds of things that could be in there, there's like a 24 that I know about in Vietnam that are not there. And I agree with you. I'll be honest. I think that should have been in there, too.
But you're very even-handed. I think this one of the things that makes the book so interesting is that it's not like 50 different variations of Indian street food. Mm-hmm. All of which it might be difficult for you to make because where are you going to get the ingredients that you need? And instead, you really took contributions from, and I'm sure they came from Lonely Planet editors around the world, but you really did give lots of people a place.
Yeah, you wanted to spread it out as much as possible. Think that the first one in the next book, let's have it start with fish and chips.
There we go.
Yeah. Now, you have a format for this, which is, there's the dish. Here's like Gotak. It says where it's from, Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia. Then a brief definition. Then in little boxes, what is it, and an explanation of what it is. Origin, a little history about it. Gotak means brains. I didn't know that. Why did I pick this one?
Well, I'll send some over to you.
That's fine. I'm still, from our last interview, I'm still waiting for my pig ear to ring. But anyhow, then you have tasting it, finding it, and variations of it. And then in another section, you have, I don't know, it doesn't seem to carry over here, you have little ideogram things that tell you if you should eat it with your hand or need utensils or whatever.
Yeah.
So it really is informative. It takes some of the mystery out of it, which is desirable because a lot of people really just don't know what to do approaching a street vendor.
We use the hand icon a lot.
Yes.
Out of those, the chopsticks and, you know, knife, fork get in there too. But it's fun to eat with your hands.
Yeah, yeah. It also has a nice shiny wrapper so that food fingerprints won't stay. Otherwise, that would be a risk, I guess.
Yeah, you can clean off the cover of the book very easily.
What is your all-time favorite street food, since I'm asking these kinds of questions?
Well, it's hard to say. I'm very fond of Mexican food in general, and I've traveled around Mexico many, many times, and I lived in San Francisco for a number of years, and that's when I first started having taco truck, the burritos, like a from stands in West Oakland, where Lonely Planet's based. So I have a very, very soft spot for things like, even if it's not brain tacos, and I have had that before, but, you know, like a taco stand. I was in Mexico recently, and I went to a little taco stand in a town called San Blas, which is about a couple hours north of Puerto Vallarta. And there was restaurants and things, but no one told me. I asked a lot of people. They said, that's the place. She makes the best tacos in town. And I went there and just sat there, and you end up talking with a couple locals and a couple expats who live there, and you're watching the scene of the town go by. So I just think that's a classic experience, and it's so hard for me to say my favorite, but my heart kind of starts with Mexico.
Not food poisoning, but I was in Guatemala. I had ice cream on the street, and that was the only case of Montezuma's revenge that I had.
Yeah, I guess ice cream being out too long, did it melt and refreeze or something like that? I don't know. I've had good experiences with ice cream on the street. I was in Russia 20 years ago this year, believe it or not.
Good.
And it was the first summer of Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union, and there was babushka women that would be out with a cardboard box on a corner selling these mounds of vanilla ice cream, which was like the thickest, creamiest ice cream I've ever had, and you would go and it would be like 1 or 2 cents. And every time I saw them, I always had to stop and get this, just literally just a little mound of ice cream. You would unwrap and just try to eat it messily, and I never had a problem. But like I said before, I haven't had food poisoning ever from anything I've got on the street. So in most cases, if they're making it, you see them make it fresh. Something like that, ice cream, that's a little bit different. How has it been kept frozen? Was it saved from the day before, etc.? Maybe something to be a little more careful about.
I think you're intrepid, and I also think you've got an iron stomach.
Possibly. I went through India, and I love, you know, one of my favorite things that is in the book is just having chai, having tea on the street. The guys come around with glasses, and they bring you the chai tea, and you just sit there, just in the middle of a busy street in Delhi or wherever you may be. And I love that. And I had that every day when I was in India and Nepal. Every day, I would constantly have the chai. And I was scared when I went to India the first time. I thought that I was going to get sick left and right, and I left without ever having any problem from eating snacks in the street or in a restaurant. So,
Now you realize, of course, what tradition you're following. You're following the tradition of the British Raj in India, and everything stops for tea in the middle of the afternoon.
That's good. And, you know, it's a little bit like the banh mi sandwich, the Vietnamese sandwich, which is described a little bit as an early fusion food, because the banh mi, which has gotten so popular that the Oxford English Dictionary added it, the Vietnamese term for sandwich, into its dictionary last year. But it's using a French baguette, use mayonnaise, it has pork liver pate, yeah, but they put pickled leeks and carrots and fish sauce sometimes and chili. So it's a real kind of mix of a French kind of sandwich and a Vietnamese kind of sandwich. And that has become so popular that many people think it's the world's best sandwich. You know, and you just get that a little stand. And it's continuing to grow there, because I've seen banh mi hamburger stands.
Yeah, well, there's
some places.
There's a taqueria here in Pittsburgh that came up with the banh mi flavor of taco. Robert
Goh. Well, we already have a start on Street Food Part 2 with fish and chips, and I'm going to be totally non-controversial and say that somewhere in the next few entries in Street Food 2 has to be the classic American tube steak and a Reuben sandwich.
Oh, yeah, Reuben. That'd be wonderful.
That's a street food.
Yeah, you buy it and eat it in the street.
Pretty messy.
That's all you need to do.
Yeah, it has to be. Yeah, so it's messy. Big deal.
You know, it is endless. I mean, it's like, you know, I live in New York, and they have the Vindy Awards, the Street Vendor Awards every year to pick the best street vendor.
Yeah, right.
And who won it last year was a guy who sets up in Astoria, Queens, outside like a little grocery store. It's called the King of Falafel and Shawarma. And I went and had the chicken dish over there and talked to him for a while. And the best meal I've had in New York in a couple of years, without a doubt. It's like just the fact it's on the street. I mean, it's just wonderful.
Great.
He has music. He has uniforms. And I asked him, why don't you want to be in a restaurant? You're so successful. And he says, I'm out here with the neighbors. I'm out here with the locals. I love being out here and not trapped in the kitchen. He loves the social quality of serving food on the sidewalk.
And where is he again?
Queens.
Astoria, Queens.
Oh, we're not going to get this.
Wonderful food.
But do you think we'll ever get Times Square to be excited like that? Times Square will ever turn out to be as exciting as the street food scene?
I don't know. Why not?
Why not?
Set up your own stand there and make the brain dish that you were talking about earlier. Why don't you set that up in Times Square? I'll be your first customer.
Okay, Robert. As always, it's fun talking to you. And thank you for joining us again. Keep the good books rolling.
And we'll be back with another view of the world of food right after this break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
So welcome back. Next, we're going to veer a little away from the street food and food truck theme.
But it is sort of instant food, right?
Well, it's... No, it's...
I mean, it's food...
it's
food... No, you don't... It's on food of the moment. So it's how to cook what's in your garden right now or what's in the market right now.
Right. Well...
I mean, there's nothing... It's almost as urgent as street food.
Well,
see, you missed my point.
Yeah, I did.
It was obviously obscure. It wasn't a very good
link. Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that we're all concerned, particularly this time of the year, with vegetables and fruits, and they're beautiful things. And some people, like me, associate colors with everything, including numbers. But here we have Cheryl Rules.
Who organized her book by colors, right?
She organized her book about fruits and vegetables by colors. So you want red, you get red. You want orange, you get the orange things.
And if you're colorblind, who knows? Like Peter, there's
you're hopeless.
No telling what you'll get. But here's a very worthwhile interview for you to listen to.
Today, if all the bloggers out there don't mind my mentioning, it seems that most of the pictures of food we get are shot on smartphones with a minimal, if at all, any concept of lighting. So it's a real joy to pick up a book where it is so masterfully photographed, the food that is. We're going to be talking to the book's author, Cheryl Sternman Rule, which is a nice, tidy name, Cheryl.
Thank you. Rule
and the name, the book is Ripe. And it was beautifully photographed by Paulette Flippo, who lives in, she's American, who lives in Idaho. Cheryl, this is a sort of an unusual presentation in a cookbook about fruits and vegetables, because usually they're presented seasonally, which is how most people think of.
Or alphabetically. Sometimes you get apples before zucchini.
But this is arranged by color, and it's certainly striking to look at. What are your colors?
The colors that we have reflected in the book are red, and then orange, yellow, green, and then we have blues and purples, and we finish up with white.
Now, why?
That's an excellent question. You know, when we picked the topic of fruits and vegetables, and actually it was Paulette's concept originally, because she has a specialty in her photography business to photograph common fruits and vegetables in uncommon ways, and it was really her idea to arrange the book chromatically to put the colors at the forefront of the entire finished product. So it was a wonderful idea and a wonderful way to make the book a little bit different from so many other fruit and vegetable focused cookbooks that are on the market today, which focus on farmers market cooking, or they focus, as you said, on the seasons, or some of them are arranged more like a dictionary or a glossary. Some are organized by meal type, so you'll have breakfast, lunch, dinner, snack. And we really wanted ours to be quite visual, and organizing it by color was the way that we decided to go.
So if you don't know if peas are green, you have to go to the index and look up peas.
That's right. And there are a few items. Apples can be many different colors.
Yes, this is true.
So the index is extremely important in this book, and we were very fortunate to have a talented indexer help us make sense for the reader so that they can find very easily what they're looking for.
Now, you have the description of the fruit or vegetable, and you have little tips throughout that, too. And then you have a section for each one called simple uses for whatever it is. Very straightforward. Like, I'm looking at edamame, and you have simple uses, succotash, noodle bowl, warm potato salad, right?
Correct.
And then you have recipes for
That's
each
exactly
one.
Right. Yep.
You were absolutely correct in stating that she has unusual perspective on the vegetables she's shooting. I'm looking at celery, which is really a rosette created by the different leaves, or stalks rather, because it was horizontally cut through, right? Sliced through horizontally.
Yes.
So it's like a little rosette.
Exactly. When people think of celery, they think about the stalks as being sort of horizontally on the table. And this one, she's giving you a perspective inside the vegetable as though it were pointing at you and you were looking almost through it to see the very heart of the celery. And I've had more people comment to me on that photograph than almost any other in the book. And I think it's because celery is often considered not a very attractive vegetable. It's something that people consider very ho-hum. It's quite average, I think, in people's minds. But Paulette, part of her genius is to be able to bring a fresh perspective, as you said, to something as common as celery. And she would be thrilled, I think, to know that you picked that one as an example as well.
Oh, good. Well, the other one that startled me was I have never, ever known what the inside of a cranberry looked like.
Yeah, I think that's right as well. People take cranberries and they take them whole and they pop them right into a pot and they boil them down until they dissolve or they pop into cranberry sauce. And there are a few reasons why anybody would have actually ever cut a cranberry in half and take a look inside, but they are a glorious-looking fruit when you take a look at the little seeds that show through.
I'm interested in the process of this. I'm looking at avocados, and I'm looking at the photograph of the avocado. It took me a while to actually focus my eyes to see what I was looking at. Now, how did this come about? What it is actually is irregularly chopped avocado with the stone still in it. Give me just a little scenario. Did she come to you and you decided together that you were going to do avocados and what the color was, and then you move on to how you were going to actually slice and present this and photograph it?
Well, that's a good question. When it came to the photography, she, as I said, had the original idea to do a fruit and vegetable coffee table book that was more of a traditional photography book. And then she brought the idea to me, and because I am a food writer and a professional recipe developer, we together at that point repositioned the concept to turn it into a cookbook. And we really had a 50-50 collaboration throughout the entire process, and it was more than a 3-year process from start to finish. And so
that's
we together
time.
it is for, you know, that was from concept. It was almost 4 years really from the time she and I first started to talk about it and today when the book is finally out on the shelves. But we came up with the list of produce items together, and she drove that process in determining which colors she thought would photograph most nicely, and then I helped her pick the ones that I was the most comfortable and most enthusiastic about cooking with, and we honed that list over time until we came up a list that we were both happy with, and then she shot the single photographs of each fruit and vegetable in her studio in Sun Valley, Idaho, and determined on her own how to present and style and photograph those shots, while I was working simultaneously in San Jose on developing the recipes. And then for the recipe photos, which are the other half of the photography in this book, I would take sort of a quick and dirty photo on my end and send it to her and say, when I make this recipe, this is how it turned out. So when you make it in your kitchen, you can either use my original idea for the recipe or you can go ahead and style it in a more creative way that better suits your photographic style.
Okay, so you made the dish, but then she also made it as well.
Probably for about half of them, that was true. The other half we did on site together. She traveled to my home in California once or twice during the process, and I packed up and traveled to her home in Idaho once or twice as well. And in those situations, I would cook the food there with her and then bring it to her, and she would plate it and maneuver it and style it according to her own vision. And I was standing there as well so we could move things around and look at the photos as she was taking them to make sure we both agreed that they were being presented consistent with both of our visions.
I have an interesting question for you.
Yes.
Can you remember which were the last one or two that got left out?
that got cut.
Yeah, which was the last cut?
I can't remember, unfortunately, because we finished and turned in the manuscript last March. So that was March of 2011. It was over a year ago at this point.
Can you think of one, even if it wasn't the last one?
I know some that didn't make it into the book originally, and they were never shot, and there were no recipes developed for them, either because we had completed that color category already, and we knew we were limited by the total number of recipes we could include. But I know that we did not include kohlrabi, which is a vegetable that people are often looking for ideas on how to use.
Oh, that would have made a fascinating photograph.
I think it would have. And in many ways, I do regret not including it, but it's not a vegetable that I was very familiar with myself.
Yeah.
And
so it's also really ugly.
It's very ugly.
But ugly can actually make an incredible photograph because it fascinates people.
Yes,
so that may be for the next book. If we have an opportunity to work together again, maybe we'll do a book about kohlrabi.
Yeah, you owe it a whole book just for the insult of leaving it out.
Oh, no.
The most amazing thing, I just want to comment here, and then I'll ask you for a thought along similar lines, because I'm king of artichokes, and artichokes wouldn't really be considered as being particularly attractive vegetables. I mean, if you like them, then you like the look of them, but otherwise you wouldn't be drawn to them. But on one of our trips to Italy, we happened upon this little town called Ladispoli, not too far north of Rome, in the province of Lazio. And we went in there for the afternoon. It was a Saturday afternoon. And we went into the town because the people where we were staying said it was worth doing and didn't seem to be anything else much going on. It turned out it was the artichoke festival.
Wow.
It was in May, and the whole town had been turned over to a celebration of artichokes, and they had the most amazing, what would you call them, flower arrangements made out of artichokes. Artichokes that were green, artichokes that were purple, and they really looked absolutely magnificent. They were being used like roses and other wonderful flowers to make displays.
You got very lucky. I'm quite envious, actually. I think that sounds like a dream come true.
If you want some photographs, if you remind me, probably still have some of the photographs, and if you're interested, I'd be happy to send them to you.
I would love to see them. You know, artichokes are very popular in Roman cuisine, so it makes sense to me that they would be celebrating them in a festival like that. In California as well, I live close to Gilroy, which is where a lot of artichokes are grown. Castro Valley, actually, I believe, is the exact place where they're grown mostly in the United States. And there's even a place called the Thistle Hut, which is like a little hut off the side of the road that's got produce. It's a produce stand, but it's got a giant beacon, a big photograph or a big imprint of an artichoke right there, and you can see it. As though it were a fast food restaurant. It's not, but it's sort of like you would see McDonald's on the side of a highway in other parts of the United States, but in Castro Valley, you have the Thistle Hut.
They're everywhere. Now, here's a trivia question for you.
Okay.
What famous person was Miss California Artichoke?
Oh, my goodness.
Early in her life.
I have absolutely no idea. Why don't you tell me?
Her name was Norma Jean.
Oh, my goodness. I did not know that. Is that true?
Norma Jean Baker, otherwise known as Marilyn Monroe.
That's incredible. That's a great tidbit.
That was her first recognition. Anyway, I will send you some artichoke photographs. In the meantime, listeners, the only thing you can do with this book is you just have to go buy a copy, because it is so absolutely glorious. The colors are so magnificent, and I wish we could transmit the colors over radio so you could see them.
And, I mean, I might say that the recipes themselves are extremely interesting, too. They're not run-of-the-mill. They're very well thought through and creative.
The only problem you'll have is, if you're like me, you're colorblind, then you won't appreciate it.
Yeah, that's...
Oh, my goodness. Are you really?
Only red-greens. So I can see the... I can see the colors, and the only difference is I can't sell some of the greens apart from the other greens.
Well, fortunately, there's enough writing in there, hopefully, to keep you entertained if you get lost in the colors.
Indeed. Thank you so much for joining
Cheryl,
us.
Cheryl, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back with the final segment of this week's show right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again for the final segment of this week's program. And what do we have now, Mrs. Rabideau?
Well, you know, we've had Gary Allen on the show before.
So he must be smart if we're having him on again. Huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's nice having somebody who's really authoritative about a subject. And if you want to know anything about herbs, you can ask Gary Allen. The first book that we talked to him about was the herbalist in the kitchen. This one is actually a global history. It's a history of herbs. Now, he's not talking about medicinal properties or anything. He's just talked about the place in our world over the years of herbs, and they've always been important.
And I think the only question we never asked him is why Anne pronounces it without an H on the beginning, and I pronounce it with an H on the beginning.
Herbs.
And there's a story that we can argue about another day. But here's Gary Allen talking about one of his favorite subjects.
Gary Allen, you wouldn't describe yourself as an herbalist, would you?
No, not really.
I think that that's kind of an issue that confuses a lot of people. We've actually interviewed herbalists on the program, but they usually do medicinal compounds. And one thing this book of yours, Herbs, A Global History, is definitely not. It's not about the medicinal qualities of herbs, right?
No, it's strictly about food.
Well, it's a charming book, a little book. And as part of the series, talk to us about what is the edible series.
Oh, yeah, it's very interesting. There's a publisher in London called Reaction Press, and they're putting out this series of single-topic food books. For instance, there's one on pancakes, there's one on hot dogs, there's one on ice cream. When mine came out, when mine was published this spring, three other books in the series were published, and they were on rum and champagne and gin, I think. But they're all single topics. They're all very, they're fun to read. They have lots of illustrations. They're inexpensive, and they all have the same design format, so it would make a great shelf full.
Oh, yes. They remind me, I used to have an old series of Shakespeare's plays, all with the same hardcover binding, and they were about this size. They were blue.
Yeah, they're pretty handy.
Yeah, I actually sold them to somebody. I don't know why. I miss those. But anyhow, the illustrations, some of them are historical.
Right.
Some of them are photographs.
All the photographs are mine.
Oh, you did that. Okay. That's good. What kind of lens?
It's a fairly small, compact camera. Nothing fancy. I used to do a lot of photography of the more formal variety, and this camera works.
The result of this is charming. Now, you have an issue here. We're talking culinary. Your issue is that nomenclature itself is very confusing, and I admitted to you that it is to me, too, because I, for my whole life, thought za'atar was a blend, a mixture of herbs, and you say it's a single herb as well.
Yeah, well, actually, it's even more than there's the blend, which has got several different herbs in it, and usually some sesame seeds as well. Then there's the herb itself, za'atar, but that is also several different species plants. And the thing they all have in common is a lot of the compound thymol, flavor ingredient in thyme.
Yes.
And they all have lots of thymol and carvacrol, which is another flavoring ingredient.
You really know a lot about herbs. What motivates you to study them so intensely?
Well, I've always been really interested in food. And about 15, 20 years ago, I started getting interested in herbs. I found that most of the books about herbs were about the same 20 herbs. They were coffee table books or whatever, but they were all the same ones. And I thought there must be more to it. So I started researching it and realized that since there wasn't a book that covered what I wanted to know, I was going to have to write it myself. And I did that. And in fact, the last time I was on your show was for that earlier book, which was more like an encyclopedia. It's not like this book. This book is fun.
Yeah, you have all these little notes of, like, Pliny the Elder advised that one should curse when planting basil seeds that helps them to grow.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
My mother used to say you have to be evil to grow garlic. All these funny stories having to do with
that. Yeah, well, you know, the English are not really fond of garlic.
Well, my mother was Italian.
So. Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Peter's the English one.
I'm sure my mother. I'm sure garlic never passed my mother's lips. At least not deliberately.
Now, she took the chives with her potatoes, if you remember. She was
just a very few, though.
A sprinkling of chives.
And they're, it's only because they're a little bit like green onions.
Right.
Otherwise, they wouldn't be allowed. She ate garlic without realizing it when she ate at our house. She wouldn't have done it on purpose, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a common problem.
And about as herbal as she got was chopped chives.
Whereas we use herbs in everything, I think that it's absolutely essential. I have my herb garden. And when I'm without it, I mean, it kills me to have to pay whole food prices on herbs, but I can't actually cook without herbs.
Yeah, it's absurd to get this little tiny package in a plastic box. That's not herbs.
Isn't that awful? Of course, then we have all these different names for herbs. We also have herbs that have a different name for each part.
Oh, yes. Yeah, coriander, for instance. Coriander in European cooking until modern times was always the seeds that were grown that they were interested in. Whereas in other cuisines, foliage, which we call cilantro, is used. In Thailand, they have separate names for the leaves, the stems, and the roots, and they're all treated as separate ingredients.
Well, they have different flavor profiles.
Yeah.
Explain some of the story you tell about how herbs get moved around the globe throughout the history.
Well, many of them traveled with the colonists who were ever going wherever they want because they wanted to have the flavors of home. But a lot of them volunteered. Herbs are basically weeds, and they can spread really easily. The seeds get mixed in with other things. They cling to people's clothing. And once they get to the new country, very often they have no competition, so they spread like weeds.
They don't. Now, this is why, because I keep asking, Peter, how do these herbs that I have in the backyard move themselves into my front garden? How big a distance is that rabbit?
Probably about 100 feet.
Mint and oregano are the two worst offenders.
Well, mint, you can find where people lived hundreds of years ago because the mint is still there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's gone, but the mint will be there.
Yeah, sure, it's hard to remove, right?
It is, yeah. Mint, you need to keep in some sort of container where no way it can get out.
Well, you know, I did that with chives, except they got out of the container. They jumped right out and started growing next to the container.
Yeah, well, the chives, the blossoms, once they mature, they drop little seeds, so they can get out that way. Mint spreads by spreading stolons, which are like a kind of extended root. So if you have mint completely enclosed in something they can't grow in, they can't spread.
Oh, okay.
But other herbs will. And another thing is birds like to eat the fruits.
I think that birds have planted most of my front garden, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, there are things that came up there that I've never planted. There's a red flower that's gorgeous, but I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. In fact, one of the things I found, when I look for wild asparagus,
yes,
I look for it underneath telephone wires, because the birds eat the berries and then sit on the wires.
I'll be darned.
And on the sides of the road, you'll very often find asparagus growing under those wires.
I'm surprised the telephone company doesn't charge you for that.
They haven't figured out a way yet. And they don't know where I live.
That's because you got rid of your landline, right?
Exactly.
Tell me what you think are some of the more interesting herbs, because you were interested in ones that were not common 20 that you found everywhere.
One of the things I found that was really fascinating when I was doing the research was the bush herbs from Australia. They have an incredible range of wild plants, many of them part of the eucalyptus family, that have wonderful flavor characteristics and properties. One of them is called a kind of wild pepper, and the seeds of them are very peppery, but the heat comes on very gradually, so that you don't just get a burst like wasabi.
Yeah,
and
what's it called?
Called wild pepper.
Are these the ones we call Tasmanian peppercorns?
That's one of the ones, yes. We're back to the common name problem.
Because they look like peppercorns, except they're soft.
Right, and if you use them in light-colored sauces, they take on a pale lavender color to the sauce. They're very nice.
I don't know where we got some. I have no idea where we got them from, but I used them rather quickly because I thought they were very, very tasty.
Yeah, we did have those. What happened to them?
We used them all up.
Yeah, they have a very nice aromatic quality, and slightly minty as well.
This Queen Anne's lace, who knew that it was edible? What kind of a flavor does it have?
Queen Anne's lace, it's exactly the same species as domestic carrot.
Well, I saw it as carota, yeah.
Right. Domestic carrots are a subspecies, but they really are the same plant initially. The roots are very tough and woody. They're no longer interesting to us. But the seeds and the flowers and the foliage are just like carrots. And carrot seed and Queen Anne's lace seed, they're closely related to caraway. So you get that carver crawl, that caraway flavor, as well as like a hint of the carrot. They're very nice.
Anyone I find, I can do that. I can eat it.
Yeah. There's no Queen Anne's lace that's toxic.
Okay.
Other members of the parsley family are, but if you really know what Queen Anne's lace looks like, you won't make a mistake.
Oh, I know what it looks like. It has a little red dot in the center, too.
Yep, that's Anne Boleyn's neck.
Is, Is it?
Yeah, if you look at it, what it is, it's a lace collar with just the
right.
Where her neck would have been.
Oh, my. Okay. So that's what it is.
And she got her head chopped off. She got her head chopped off.
Terminal trouble.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a foolproof method of deciding when I'm foraging what is a weed or what is an edible weed. And that's, I taste it. And we interviewed somebody who said, this is not a good idea. You're in an area that grows, you know, hemlock and sumac and all this stuff.
Yeah. Hemlock is in the same family. that is something to... You know, there's a famous line that there are old mushroomers and there are bold mushroomers, but there are no old bold mushroomers. It applies here, too.
Well, my grandmother used to insist that you did something with a coin in the water to see if it was poisonous or not.
Do not use that method. That is not the best method is to go with somebody who knows what they're doing.
Well, Gary, I hope you do really well with this book. It's a very precious book. I mean, it's something that you like to have and refer to.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, and so I wish you well with it. And also, I haven't tried the recipes, but now I know where they are. I will do. And what's next?
One other thing. Well, actually, I just finished the next book in the series on sausage, so that's about a year away from publication.
Oh, sausage. Now, that's great.
Yeah, that sounds like a good book.
It was fun. I volunteered to do the one on game next, but they'd already signed somebody up to do it.
Oh, game. That would be fun, too. Well, I don't know. How about popcorn? I will do popcorn.
that might have been done already.
Oh, okay.
That might be a very small book.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's somebody growing teeny tiny pop. Anyhow, Gary, I thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us about it and keep us posted on your projects.
And before you go eating any more wild plants, let me know what you're thinking about first.
Okay.
I'd like to talk to you again
today. Okie doke.
Okay.
Actually, Peter makes me eat them all first before I put them in his salad.
Well, that's wise for him.
Yeah. Okay, Gary, so we could go on with this, but I think that we'll check in the next time on your next book, Sausage.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary.
And we'll be back with you again next week, same time, same place. We'll be talking Italy, I think.
I hope.
So I'm sure you'll be interested in that, and we look forward to you joining us then. In the meantime, until next week.
Bye-bye.